I kept getting fired from job after job. And finally, I was like, all right, you know what? I'm just going to like chillax, make some pots, sort of see what happens, and give up on my idea of a fancy career and a jappy lifestyle and just kind of, you know, become a potter.
We talked about fitness before. We talked about faux spiritual fitness and couples who work out together and manic fitness versus relaxed fitness as it pertains to your personality. You know, I do know a decent amount about diets because I grew up in an unhealthy household as it pertains to food and exercise. And the word diet was something very common in my house. And you ripped out every magazine from Cosmopolitan or whatever magazines were popular then and promising if you eat this food in 1 week and it had the pictures of everything you're supposed to eat, then you're going to lose weight. And back then it used to be every single person was on a diet and every single diet had conflicting rules. So I remember there was something that back then was called the stewardess diet, which is now would be the flight attendant's diet. And it literally had like one whole day of all fruit and then one whole day of all vegetables, then one day of beef and tomatoes, then a day you could have a hot dog and two scoops of ice cream. Like it was literally the constipation diet, the ADD diet, the let's see how stupid people are diet, where, I mean, if you ate fruit all day, vegetables another day, and just if you ate pizza or popcorn one day, you'd probably lose weight because you're not going to eat 50 pieces of pizza. Like all of these crazy diets have the word die in them, D-I-E. I don't believe in the word. I hate to even say the word today. But I just, having gone through so many years and so many iterations of this multi-billion dollar industry, it just brings me to believe we are so stupid. So I listen to everybody now, it's keto, and I'm on the keto, and I do keto. I practice keto. And keto is basically like a cousin of Atkins and South Beach and Zone. So Atkins really started where it was you could eat 65 steaks, 45 pieces of bacon, 30 scrambled eggs, as much cheese as you want, Cobb salad dressing, Caesar salad dressing, etc. You ate a fucking stick of Trident gum, you'd gain 40 pounds. Like it was literally, you eat a piece of watermelon and the carb police are going to come to your house and arrest you. And you were supposed to buy these like urine sticks that you peed on because you're supposed to go into ketosis, which many doctors say is not a good thing for your body to go into. Not to mention that really is the constipation dehydration diet. Like you can eat 400 pieces of beef jerky, but you're not allowed to have an orange slice. You're not even allowed to probably have, you might be allowed to have some lemon in your water. But like, this is fucking crazy. And then years later, the Atkins diet bars came out. And these were like sort of okay, but they had some carbs and God only knows. And then that diet sort of changed a little bit more to be more sort of human. And the South Beach diet is a distant, healthier cousin of the Atkins diet, but it was basically that you could just never like combine food. So if you were gonna eat the steak with the vegetables and the lettuce and the 10 pounds of dressing, that was okay. But on the meals that you were gonna have whole wheat pasta, because white is not okay, whole wheat pasta is okay. On those meals, because you were eating carbs, you weren't allowed to have any fat. You could only have like the carbs with the tomato sauce and the vegetables, but no fat. Fat only goes with protein at those meals, okay? So this is how crazy this was. Then there were other food combining diets where you're not allowed to eat anything in the morning and then you're allowed to eat fruit, but you cannot eat fruit any part of the day besides the morning. You can't eat fruit in between meals. You can't eat fruit after a meal. You can only eat fruit in the morning on an empty stomach. Incidentally, that makes some sense because your body, after it's been fasting all night, acid in orange or citrus or fruit in the morning is best digested on an empty stomach. And the food combining thing does make some sense. It's why after Thanksgiving dinner, you are so exhausted. It's not because of the tiny amounts of tryptophan you're getting in your turkey. It's because of all the different food groups that your body's trying to digest at the same time. So the machine is working overtime, which is why fasts and cleanses and juicing do have their health benefits if supervised, if you understand them. Meaning, when your body, the machine is off and you're only eating, let's say, fruits and vegetables, or you're not eating animal or sugar or caffeine or meat, which is harder to digest, or you've taken it to the next level and you're doing just different types of smoothies and soups, which also calms your system because it's not working overtime to digest that food. and take it to the next level if you're doing green juices or regular juices, or when people do the master cleanse, which is way more extreme, or people even do a water fast. The point is, people do heal themselves this way because the machine, which is your body, is focusing on itself versus like the energy that the machine takes to digest food. But we could do a whole other thing on that. That could be an entire podcast in and of itself, and I'd be willing to do it. So after the Atkins diet came out, maybe 10 years later, there used to be the Beverly Hills diet, I forgot. There used to be the California diet, the Mediterranean diet, the San Francisco diet. I mean, it sounds like I'm making all this up. It's all real. So Atkins is like all fat, all protein, all animal, all like clogged arteries and constipation and ketosis. On the other end, there used to be this woman named Susan Powder who had bleached blonde platinum short hair. She used to go on television with piles, and I mean piles for drama, piles of pasta, piles of baked potatoes, piles of pretzels, anything. Fat-free. It's fat-free. You can eat fat-free as long as you eat only fat-free. It has no fat. You can eat as much of it as you want. Steak, bad. Fat. Oil, bad. Avocado was the goddamn motherfucking devil, okay? The devil. I used to think avocado was a sin. Like back in the days of when sushi came out, avocado was a sin. Now I literally, I bathe in avocado. I rub it all over my body and then I lick it off. So back then, avocado was the goddamn devil. But 40 pounds of pasta was okay as long as you didn't have a drip of oil in it. So if you went to a restaurant, you had to like literally take the waiter by the throat and make sure that there was no oil whatsoever used in the process of making that pasta. And then that was when everything became fat-free and everything that used to be Atkins and everything that was whatever became fat-free. So you'd be at food shows and anybody who had fat in their products was a loser. And anybody, everything was fat-free. And then people started promoting bread, fat-free, pretzels, fat-free. We're like, pretzels were always fat-free. You know what I mean? Like they started being like, Diet Coke is fat-free. It's like, no shit. It's always been fat-free. Brown rice, fat-free. We know it's fat-free. So that was that. And then a later happy medium was the low-carb diet. So now you were sort of back to the South Beach diet with another name. So everything is a remix. I think it was like Bill Gates said it. Everything's a remix. All of it's bullshit. I don't know what to tell you. I could go on for days. I will go on another time. But I'm just saying, like, be sensible, okay? Have a decent relationship with food. The one rule I could tell you is do not binge and make good investments. Meaning if you are going to eat plain grilled chicken, which bores me, you can eat more of it. If you're going to eat fatty ribeye, which excites me, you're going to eat less of it. If you are PMS or you need a piece of chocolate cake, try not to eat the whole thing, but then don't have bread and wine after and during dinner. Like, you know what? Balance it out. It's checks and balances. It's the same way you spend your money. Just spend wisely. Try to get an ROI, return on your investment. And meaning if you eat something healthy, you're going to feel good or it's going to fill you up like a salad and chicken or soup or whatever. And if you don't invest wisely, then make up for it elsewhere. My guest today is designer Jonathan Adler, who is at the top of his game. He has an interior design brand of all these different products to just make your house come alive. It's whimsical, it's fun, like him, and it's a signature style. I have several pieces of his work in my home, and I truly, truly love his work. It is a brand. So he's here because he has absolutely, unequivocally built a brand and also built an e-commerce business, which is huge and truly necessary in this day and age. So he started out as a potter, and now he has stores all over the country. I am so excited to share our conversation with you today as we talk about how he developed his brand and he became a household name, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I do. Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. So nice to see you.
So nice to see you also. I just finished a place in Connecticut and you are ever present. My daughter has those multiple color bubble bedside lamps. And I have those sort of mixed metal sconces in my dining room. You know, the ones that like have the lines in gold and maybe in
row. Yeah, it's like a swirl.
I've got the evil eye table. I mean, almost erring on the side of buying too much of your stuff that it looks like you're in my house. I'm all in with everything.
Never enough, never too much. All right. Well, heart you.
I think you're amazing. I could go on. I have so many things in my house and I think you're so creative and so innovative. And you know, there are many successful and talented and AD Architectural Digest published designers, but you can't name that many that have an actual brand. And this show, the filter on this brand is not about being famous, rich, or powerful. It's about having built a brand or being a game changer, you know, created an industry, a maverick, started from the bottom, now we're here. So that's why it was important to me to talk to you, because I mean, I really can't think of very many people that have built a brand like yours that is constantly changing and that is obviously thriving. And it's just desirable and interesting and quality and fun. And you're kind of checking so many of the boxes.
Well, thank you very much. I'm, you know, doing what I can, just trying to stay relevant and, you know, stay creative.
Well, how long do you feel that you have been relevant?
Well, it's actually a really interesting question. I started my business quite accidentally like 27 years ago, hashtag old. And the idea of relevance is kind of interesting because I feel like I've been very, very lucky that I've had a long run and I hope I'm still relevant. I mean, it's not something I think about very much. I really think about trying to stay authentic and true and just kind of follow my creative muse wherever she leads me. And I think that the idea of relevance, like, I think as long as you're authentic, you're relevant. And that's kind of how I approach it.
And evolving.
And evolving.
Evolving. Well, I know what I like, but I think commercially, which is ultimately what you're doing as a brand, I mean, you don't want to just be niche. I think you probably are more relevant than you ever have been. And to me, it keeps evolving. I mean, it's been the last 10 years that I feel like it's popped off. That's what I think, but I may not know everything.
Well, bless your heart. I hope that's true.
That's what I really do think. So you started off by doing pottery, right? Like you're a potter by trade?
Yeah, I started off, as I said, a long time ago, making pottery, thinking it was something I always wanted to do with my life. But of course, I'm a little bit jappy, and it never crossed my mind that I would be able to have a jappy lifestyle and be a potter. Luckily, I failed at every job I ever had when I was young. So when I got out of college, I tried to work in the movie business and I had a very poor work ethic and very loose morals. So I would show up late. I was sleeping with my boss and everybody else in the office.
You're like J-Law in Silver Linings Playbook when she said she got fired because she slept with everyone. And Bradley Cooper says, well, how many people? She said 11. He's like, oh, that's a number.
Well, I couldn't. Unfortunately, I wasn't even as good as she is. I sucked at everything. So I kept getting fired from job after job. And finally, I was like, all right, you know what? I'm just going to like chillax, make some pots, sort of see what happens and give up on my idea of a fancy career and a jappy lifestyle and just kind of, you know, become a potter. It was very like Brooklyn-y in Williamsburg before that idea even existed.
Got it.
And then, you know, miraculously over the years, I managed to be an actual Brooklyn-y potter and a Jap. So I made it all happen. It all came full circle for me. But yeah, I started out as a potter a long time ago and just was in my studio all day making stuff and got an order from Barney's and just filled the order and very gradually continued to get more orders and never really had a plan, never even really thought I was launching a business or really doing much of anything. Considered myself unemployed until about 2 years after I had gotten that first order from Barney's. I was at a party and my mom was there and someone said to me, like, Jonathan, what are you doing? You know, do you have a job? And I said, no, I'm unemployed right now. And my mother said, no, you're not. You're a potter. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm a potter. And I thought, I have a career. I'm a potter.
Well, how were you supporting yourself during that time? Did you come from a privileged background? Because you said Jap, like Jewish American princess, which might have been...
Yeah, Jewish American princess. I came from sort of a nice, solidly upper middle class, but not rich family.
Got it.
I went to a fancy college. And for some reason or other, all my friends were these like heiresses. And they never really had to think about working. And I thought, for some reason, I just sort of took on their identity and thought, well, why would one really have to work? And cut to, I got out of school and I was like, oh, one has to work because one has to pay the bills. So, yeah, so I was very lucky. You know, my parents paid for college and they were always there to help. But it wasn't, you know, dynastic wealth that my friends had. However, I think that one of the benefits of being friends with a lot of kind of like fancy, designy, stylish people from college was that I never really developed a practical streak. And I think that served me well as a designer, because I've really approached my work not from a level of like, not from a real sense of practicality or business, but more from sort of an airy-fairy artistic approach. And that's something I've managed to stay true to.
Well, I think what's great about your brand and what you've just said, though, is so if I design something, I like it to be not too taste specific, so I then can accessorize with things that you make and have those be the moments versus like every single thing I have being like making a loud statement. So I think that's where your brand is amazing, because if you just need something to just make something look fun, lighthearted, special, designed, it kind of comes in with a lighting fixture, with a vase, with a piece of furniture, a pillow. So I think that's really something that's amazing. I know you have obviously major pieces of furniture and I own them, but I think that's a cool element about your brand.
Well, you know what that really comes from? I had a very groovy grandmother who was sort of an anti-main type of person. And I remember I would go to her house and she had fabulous taste, and I would pick up an object and it would be completely riveting and inspirational and transformational. I would like pick up a sculpture off the table and say, "Where's this from?" And she said, "Oh, it's in Denmark. And I found this jeweler and he made this thing." Or, you know, I was in Mexico and I went to an ironsmith thing. And
moments.
She just had fabulous inspirational moments. And I think that I've always strived to be the dude who makes the stuff that the next generation of me's will pick up and be like, "Oh, this is cool. This is inspiring. This makes me want to make stuff." So, you know, I hope I'm making the stuff that will sort of be weird and provocative and trigger people's imaginations. And my real goal in life is to sort of battle the basic.
That's interesting. Do you retire things or limit production so people can't get it anymore? And do you still have like the basic classics that everybody wants? Like, do you strategically do that?
I'm the absolute worst. I wish I could say that I was more varsity in my strategy. And I know I should be at this point, but you know, I do a lot of stuff intuitively and what feels right. So I might retire some stuff if I'm sick of it, or if I still love it, I keep it around. It really, I'm sort of the arbiter of what stays and goes. However, talking about my company, my business, what my brand, whatever you want to call it, makes me realize what a kind of junior varsity person I am, in that I never really have had a business plan. I've never really been as strategic as I should be. And perhaps that's what I hope keeps me authentic.
I didn't ever really have a business plan, but I am very strategic. And what would you say your brand is in the elevator pitch?
You know, we call our brand kind of modern American glamour. And okay. It's a reflection of the fact that my design is, I hope, modern. You know, I always am trying to push the envelope, make things that are new and forward thinking. I think that my work is very American in that
totally.
I am very American dude. I love this country. I love this sense of optimism and possibility that is uniquely American. And so modern American and glamour, because I think glamour, I hope, is at the core of everything I do. And glamour is one of those funny words that people throw around but can't ever really define. It's sort of an ineffable thing. But I guess to me, glamour means being memorable. You know, so yeah, modern, new, American, optimistic, glamorous, memorable.
I love it. I get it. And it's true. A little retro, I feel like. So many designers, many very successful designers have made mistakes. I'm talking more in fashion, the way when I'm thinking about it in my mind and who I'm thinking about, have made mistakes in that they're amazing, brilliant designers, but not amazing business people. And that some of them have made the mistake of thinking they're good business people. And some have made the good choice to have amazing business partners who are literally just business guys or gals, and they're the designer. So do you It sounds like you know what you know and you know what you don't know, because before you were explaining that you're JV in certain ways. So it sounds like you know what you know. Do you consider yourself to be a business person in addition to a designer, or really just a creative and you need to have the right people around you to do the business?
I've become an accidental businessman. You know, it's not something I even understood at all going into this. I didn't even know what an invoice was. I was an extremely airy-fairy, impractical person. And over the years, I've, of course, had to learn how to navigate the world.
I'm the same, by the way. Shocking to people. Yeah. I'm the same, by the way.
I'm sure. I think that's as it should be. I don't think you can be you, or, you know, where you're like, you're weird. You know, you're this one-off thing. You can't become that weird one-off thing by being a business person. You have to just be you and then learn the business as it unfolds, or else you wouldn't be able to be you, you know? But over the years, of course, I've had ups and downs, and I've had fabulous business partners and unfabulous business partners, and businesses evolve and they're sort of like living organisms. And if you were to take a snapshot of my company at any given time, it might be, I might have the perfect team or I might have the imperfect team. Right now, we are killing it. We have an amazing team.
How many?
Probably like 100.
That's a lot. I'm not surprised because you have a massive business. And where is everybody?
And right now, because of the pandemic, where is everybody? We're in far-flung locales doing everything virtually and, you know, managing to keep it all together. And P.S., as it relates to the pandemic, I am an extraordinarily lucky person to be one of the few who hasn't been destroyed by the pandemic. And, you know, I certainly don't take it for granted. And I really don't know what I would have done had I been, say, 15 years younger and earlier in my company, where like I didn't sort of have the scale or the support to weather this. You know, I don't know what I would have done if I was like a small business owner during this time. I probably would have been like, if I was like younger and at that stage, to be honest, I think I probably would have been like going in every day and like, and defying all orders just to keep my business alive. I have tremendous sympathy for small business owners who are not going into their store. You know, it's a really tough position. And I think as a small business owner, I really understand that business is war. It's really meaningful. Building something is extraordinarily difficult. I feel awful for all of the small business owners who are being decimated, and I'm happy I'm not in their shoes, and I really honestly don't know how I would have handled it. I think I probably would have been pretty bold and
defiant.
I think I would have been.
Yeah.
I get angry. And I think that's a reflection. Yeah. Business is war.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that if you have a small business, you know, whether you have insurance, whatever you have, you're still kind of a little bit of a warrior. And I think that was an important part of my journey. And I feel awful for people right now.
That's awful. So well said. I'm glad you said it. We haven't talked enough about it. Do you have partners in this business and this brand?
I do. And that was something that I kind of developed over time. You know, I've had the good luck and smart luck to find people and resources that I need to continue my journey. Funnily enough, the main focus, though, for me has always just been creativity. So I kind of see my whole thingy as a very selfish endeavor, in that my goal in life is just to make groovy stuff and keep doing it as long as I can, and finding the resources and ways to make it all happen. So, you know, I see my business as more of a means to an end than an end in and of itself.
Well, there's so many people that listen here for brand building and business. Do you feel that you still have control? And, you know, if you have partners, you've had to give some either control or some, obviously, percentage money IP away. And what advice do you have to people? What sort of mistakes have you made? What has been good about it? Because what's odd is that I get a lot of emails and messages from people asking me, they tell me how much money they're making and they tell me the piece of their business that they have and what they're paying themselves a year, but someone wants to come in and take part of it. And should they take some money off, you know, then you get a pile of money and get some money off the table, and you know the drill. It's like the mini Shark Tank all the time. So how has that affected you? Because I own 100% of the Skinny Girl IP and the brand, which surprises people because I only sold the cocktail portion. And now my non-compete is up. And so I'm going to launch another cocktail, not with Skinny Girl because I don't own Skinny Girl. And for a decade, I was still involved because I was still a spokesperson. I had a back-end deal. So in owning 100%, it's been a conversation. I actually had the conversation with Mark Cuban, who's been on here, if I would sell part of it and what the reason would be and what I would use the money for, et cetera. So do you have control and how do you feel about having other people involved? And what was that decision like in that journey to do that?
Oh my God, I was so happy to get other people involved because I hated having all the responsibility myself. So I started off, it was me, a lump of clay, which is essentially just earth, water, and fire. You know, it's like a like making pots is extremely elemental and basic. It's primitive even. And I was quite primitive. And to go from that world in which it was just me, mud, fire, and water to this world I'm at, I feel incredibly grateful. And every step of the way, the more people I've brought in and the bigger my company has become, the happier I am to give up a piece of it and sort of acquire a merry band of co-conspirators in this journey who all share the responsibility and the passion. You know, I felt when it was me, fire, water, and clay, I felt really overwhelmed by everything. So the journey of having people who are as invested in this and in as invested in me as I am in this has actually been an incredibly fabulous emotional journey, not to get all like whatever.
No, it's cool.
But you know, when I first started, it felt very overwhelming and very frightening.
Suffocating.
Yeah. So I'm thrilled to have to be a part of a team now rather than to be a one-man band.
Wow. Okay. So it's been positive because you're as a designer, it seems like you've made the right moves and the right choices or got lucky or a combination of all. So it's been positive. Like you're happy with the partnerships and you are happy that you gave away a piece of your business to for the greater cause and to really blow it out and build it.
Oh my God, totally. And I think that's more a reflection of who I am as a person. Like I'm not a gambler. I hate gambling, in fact. I'm sort of risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
And my genuine like priority in life is to make groovy stuff. Like that's what occupies my brain.
And you need to be able to be free to do that. And this gives you the free. Got it. I get it.
Yeah. And so if I was spending all day and night worrying about like business and banks and risk and blah, 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 I think it would really impede my ability to do what I do.
I agree. I get it completely too, because it's something that takes up so much bandwidth is taking you away from what you really would like to be doing. And I've had that experience too with having good business managers, doing a show on HBO Max called The Big Shot with Bethany and finding someone that I would like to be me. I don't want to have all these ideas and think about all these things. I want to sometimes be the talent and not be the CEO. Sometimes be just free to be doing my podcast, talking to you, and not be thinking about the 7,000 things that I'm thinking about. Because I'm
yeah.
Anyway.
Who needs the Michigas?
Yeah.
You know, there's enough Michigas in the world that, like, you know, for me, it's like, do I want to be Jeff Bezos or do I want to be me? I'm sure he's like loving being that rich, but like that ain't my focus. My focus is on making groovy stuff. And yeah, you know, I'm also a lucky dude in that, like, I'm gay. I don't have a huge amount of responsibility. It's just like me, my adorable husband, Simon, and our cute dog, Foxy. And, you know, I just don't have that much responsibility. So I think that my focus can be being creative and probably being really selfish. I'm awful.
I was going to say, there should be a product of yours that like says the word selfish on it. I don't know what the piece is.
I know, right?
Yeah,
I
think you should have a selfish signature piece. What is your favorite piece of all of your work? And what is your favorite thing to do?
Oh my God, probably whatever I've made most recently is my favorite thing. But if I had to say, perhaps it's like I make this groovy vase called a Dora Maar vase.
I have it.
It's thank you for your custom. I appreciate it.
I have the one that also that has painted on it, not just the one where it is the face, but you have the faces painted on it. That was, I think, an H&M moment.
Yes, I did that. Yeah, exactly. I think that piece is a real reflection of me at my best, which is I hope I make things that look kind of like they were always just meant to be And like, I really sort of channeled them rather than created them. And I think that's what that vase reflects. Like, it's, you know, it
came
almost
out of you.
It kind of just came out of the world and I was merely there to unearth it. Yeah. I mean, that's how I think things should look. I think things should look completely effortless, like they're just there. But unfortunately, nothing is ever that simple. But so, yeah, I think my work at its best looks like so obvious that you just think to yourself, like, oh, how could the world have ever not had that in
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Are you decisive? Because the way that I look at design and the way that you design, when I look through a lot of the pictures, it's like cooking. You could easily use cilantro, basil, or parsley in a fish recipe with olive oil and garlic, and it would be great all of those ways. And you just have to make a decision and keep it moving. And so when I look at the design, some of it seems like crazy, accidental, ends up looking good. And I feel like it's a little bit like cooking, where the decisions, pick a decision and keep it moving. It could have been blue, green, yellow, it doesn't matter. Just then go to the next thing that goes with that.
That is like the smartest thing you've ever said. That's exactly what it is. And yeah, I am super decisive. And one of the fabulous things about being an applied artist versus like a fine artist is that I have just a ton of things on the go all the time. I have to make decisions constantly about, you know, anything from a sofa to a chair to an interior to a pot, blah, blah, blah. It's not like I sit there and, you know, contemplate the next brush stroke I'm going to take. And I think that pace of decision-making and being decisive, I hope, gives my work a feeling of freshness and clarity. And I think things shouldn't be overworked. I always think about hairdressers and how really good hairdressers are pretty quick. And they understand that, like, you kind of just got to, like, start cutting and go and not think too hard about it. And I think the same applies to design. It applies to cooking, to business, to life, to everything.
I agree.
Being decisive and quick.
I agree. And people at home are listening. And I'll say that, for example, my girlfriend, she's been obsessing over what to do with her kitchen for like a year and then obsessing over when to organize her closets. I'm like, just pick something and keep it moving. It ain't that deep. There could be seven things you could pick and then nest around that. Move stuff around. Use things you have. Like, I took a bench that's outdoor furniture in my house. It's been outside for 6 months. And I just took it and I like wiped it off. I'm like, that would be good behind my couch just to hold a candle. Like, a lot of different things work. You have to start looking at things differently. When I used to go to IKEA and find these planters, I was like, oh, they'd be good for kitchen utensils. Like, and everything you already have in your house is something you probably could use in some different way. I use Ziploc containers for my daughter's crayons and markers and buttons and extra pieces. And I use the clips from binder clips for chips if I'm out of it. Like, everything can work in different ways if you just open your eyes, I think.
Totes, especially Ziploc bags. Oh my God.
I die. I can't even talk about it.
My adorable husband, Simon, his dad had a great saying, which was about just how you have to make a decision. He said, look, everything has to be some way. So just make a decision and move on.
Exactly.
Like, don't be paralyzed. You know, it's going to be what it's, you just have to make a decision. Everything has to be some way.
If you've ever done a co-brand, I would like to do whimsical permanent Ziploc bags that have like where that snap thing is neon or something and says on it makeup. And so it's like a more durable Ziploc bag to put inside for your toiletries or things like that. That would be just like, you know, something we could cook.
Yes, it's a great idea.
You like
it? I want it. Need it. I love it.
Right. Or the Ziploc containers. We could make our own containers and I could sell them on HSN. Anyway.
Totes.
So think about it. Think about it. What does someone get you as a gift? People must be so intimidated by getting you a gift.
I hope nobody ever gets me anything because I'm like, dude, I have enough stuff. Like, if like, just give it straight to Housing Works.
But I'm like that, but I don't like not getting, I'm a gifter.
Are you?
Yeah,
well, thank God you are. If you need to buy a gift, you can just go straight to jonathanadler.com. But if you need to buy a gift for me, don't bother. I don't want more stuff.
Not even if it's food or something like that?
Except for food, of course.
Okay, so we'll get a different gift. Food. Okay, great. Food.
Yeah, all I do, I eat and eat and eat, and I work out and I work out and I work out. And I'm like a hamster on a wheel, eating and exercising and eating and exercising. It's a disaster.
What?
But yes, food.
That's noisy. That's food and exercise noise. If you exercise just a little bit less, then you wouldn't want to eat as much. But that's a different conversation for a different day. What do you give as gifts? And do you give your own brand? Do you give Jonathan Adler always?
Always.
Okay, good.
Yeah, of course. Sometimes I'll encounter like a designer who doesn't wear his own clothes or, you know, who doesn't live with his or her own stuff. And I'm like, well, then why are you inflicting it on the rest of the world? Right. Like, if you don't love it, don't make it.
Right. That was like a Housewives moment when the woman She by Sheree wasn't wearing She by Sheree. Not that it really
existed. Oh my God, She by Sheree is, I talk about She by Sheree every single day of my life, and I'll tell you why. When She by Sheree was launching her first collection, she like hired a designer. Yeah, collection. She hired a designer. She got like all the samples made, and she was getting her samples the day of her show.
Sounds normal.
And she got them, and she was like, wait, this doesn't look like I thought it would look. And she got all upset. And I was like, Sheree, obviously, like the samples is the very first step in a very, very long, arduous, analytical massaging process.
It's an edit. It's the edit. It's the book that's now in the edit.
Oh, dude, it's like it's like people say writing is rewriting, designing is redesigning. Like, get the first sample sucks. But the tough part isn't coming up with the design. The tough part is getting the first sample, seeing how much you hate it.
And how and it then, feels like, and tastes and everything that's wrong with it. Exactly. And you're a person who comes from a place of yes, but still, you know that samples are shit.
They're shit. And you need to like, you hate yourself. You think, ugh, I screwed everything up. But then you got to like roll up your sleeves and say like, all right, how can I fix this? How can I make the proportions better? Why don't the materials look good? Blah, 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 blah. And She by Sheree is emblematic of a current challenge in our culture, which is everybody thinks they're a brand, everybody thinks they're a designer, nobody wants to do the actual work.
Oh, that's totally true. And I guess I was going to say, She by Sheree has never been emblematic of anything until this moment. And yes, She by Sheree is emblematic of that.
I literally talk about She by Sheree.
Every Housewives brand ever launched. Well, many. Wow. Well, it was so good talking to you. I think you're wonderful, and I'm so proud of you, and I think your success is well-deserved. And I honestly congratulate you and just wish you the best of everything. And I appreciate you coming on here because you're an amazing company, I will tell you that. We have good, good stuff going on.
100% right back at you, ditto on all of the above. You are fabulous, and this was like such a great chance to like really bro down with you.
100%. It happens where I know people but never really get to talk to them about these things, and I love that part about this.
Yeah, like I've known you forever, but we haven't had a proper bro down, so I'm glad we did.
Me too.
And I hope more to come.
So Jonathan Adler's really interesting because he just kind of created a job, a career, and a business and a brand out of a passion. And I can relate to that because I'm a person who tried to be an actress, wasn't really that good at it, didn't feel natural at it because it wasn't me just being me. And being a host wouldn't be me because that also felt sort of stagey and scripted. So just being me ended up how I started my career on television. And I just like that he loved doing pottery. He didn't do well at working. And so he thought, you know, he was sort of possibly going to fail. He didn't know how he would succeed, which I can relate to, and many of us can. But when you just are good at something and find a way to hone that skill and find a way to market and monetize that skill, it's amazing. And, you know, he really just took a passion and then just was selling those items and realized that they have some value. And then what you do with that is really important. So he just went one step at a time in his trajectory and really created a signature brand. You understand exactly what it is when you see it. He knows exactly how to describe it in an instant. He really doesn't stray from the line to which all things adhere. And I mean that when you have a brand, you should be able to describe exactly what that is in an elevator to somebody. And you may want to later elaborate, but I know that my brand and Skinny Girl is practical solutions for women. And in the Bethany brand that I'm just launching in eyewear soon is elevated solutions for women. So you kind of get it. And with his brand, he could describe it to you, but I would say it's fun, whimsical, not taking yourself too seriously design, and, you know, high quality and colorful. And he could describe it better than I could. But with each business that we talk about and with each person who is definitely a success in their own right in some way, you can piece together your own puzzle for your own business and your own brand or your own life. Just everybody has these life hacks and life tips about just their journey. So that's kind of what this whole thing is about. I appreciate you listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. So please remember to rate, review, and subscribe Just Be With Bethany, because it's kind of how we get feedback and stay at the level we're at and get these amazing guests and have these interesting conversations. And it just really helps. The interaction is helpful to us. And to find out exactly who you are, that gives us an insight into who you are and what you want. So thank you so much as always. Have a great day. Just Be is hosted by me, Bethany Frankel. Our managing producer is Fiona Smith, and our producer is Stephanie Stender. Sarah Katnack is our assistant producer, and our development executive is Nayantara Roy. Just Be is a production of Be Real Productions and Endeavor Content. This episode was mixed by Sam Baer. To catch more moments from the show, follow us on Instagram at Just Be with Bethany.